Okay, this is our second class of the Kaddish Connections class, where we, throughout the year, we're going to be discussing various issues with regards to mourning and death. The last time we had this class, we discussed what the role is of the body. Why do we value the body so much after death? If the way we define ourselves is based on the soul, ultimately our soul is the one that continues to live after death. So then why do we value the body so much? In terms of just the whole burial process, that's what the Chevra Kedisha does. They're very much involved in purifying the body. That's what we dealt with last time. And today I want to deal with not the body, but the soul. We'll deal with what happens to the soul after death. In future classes, each class is really independent in and of itself. But in future classes, we'll deal with the role of Kaddish, the psychology behind mourning, different aspects in terms of that. So in terms of the soul after death, it's pretty interesting. If you look throughout the Torah, you don't really find any section that is involved in what happens to the soul after death. It's not discussed. If you look at the written Torah, it's not mentioned at all. Really, it's not mentioned at all. The whole process of what happens after death, which is very peculiar, because if that's really an end goal, if that's really something which we very much care about, so then why isn't it mentioned? And also, if it's not mentioned, so then we also have to ask, so then why are we having this class? Apparently it's not important. So then if it's not important, so then we shouldn't have this class. Why are we addressing something which the Torah itself doesn't even address? There's no reason to address it. So if you look at your page here of what we're discussing, so there are three answers here, but does anybody have any suggestions as to why the Torah might not mention it? Why would we not? It is something which we do care about very much so, as we'll see. But it is not mentioned in the Torah at all. Anything, there are hints to it. It is important to mention that there are definitely hints to such an idea of the fact that there's life after death. The various times in the Torah where it mentions it, the Torah says that the ultimate punishment is kares, is a form of just completely absolving of the soul, that you just lose your entire soul. That's the ultimate punishment. That's the worst punishment that exists. So that definitely implies that there's a life after death, that the soul continues to exist. The vast majority of us who continue to have a soul after death, it's only the wicked, the very wicked, who do not have that. But the vast majority of us, it's clear that there is something which exists after death. But it's never directly mentioned. Directly, it's not mentioned in the Torah explicitly, which is very peculiar. Yes?
Possibly because the Torah is usually a narrative, whereas discussing the afterlife is more philosophical.
So that is an interesting idea. There's four sheets in the back, if anybody can get it. But it is an interesting idea, and some do mention it. I'm only going to discuss three answers, and that's not one of the answers that I wanted to discuss, but that is mentioned.
I'll leave.
That is mentioned amongst the... There are other answers beyond ones that we're going to discuss. But it's a good idea. Yes.
Maybe it's because Torah is what your mission is in this life. But once you die, that's it. There's nothing you can do.
So there's no practical relevance. The Torah deals with our lives. It deals with practicality. Is that what you want to suggest?
It's telling what you need to do in your life, and once you die, your life's over.
So let's just embellish on what Mike, right? First thing is Mike. And what Mike is saying there. We're saying that the Torah is about what you do in your life. And it's not about post your life. So the Rambam, Maimonides, gives this as the third, as slightly gives a similar explanation in his third answer. In the third answer that we're going to be presenting here, which we'll address first because Mike already mentioned it. But Maimonides says that we don't discuss the afterlife because we want you to perform the commandment, and we want you to live a right and just life for the purpose of living a right and just life. You shouldn't really be thinking about the afterlife. We're not here to get the candy at the end of the tunnel, at the very end. That's not why we're here. We're here to live purposeful lives for the sake of living purposeful lives. It's true. In the end, we will get reward for the good that we do, and we will also, unfortunately, get punished for the bad that we do. But that's not why we do what we do. Ultimately, we do what we do because it's right. It's the right thing to do. So that's what Maimonides says. So therefore, the Torah doesn't put an emphasis on it. It doesn't put an emphasis on it. It is interesting to point out, though, the Torah does put an emphasis on other rewards. There are other rewards which we do put an emphasis on, physical rewards and physical punishments. There are also punishments which are physical in this world that will either have an enjoyable and good life or we will get punished. The Torah does mention punishments in the physical world. But perhaps the idea behind that is that that it will mention, but the ultimate reward, what's going to happen in the next world, doesn't even come into comparison to what will happen in this world. The good that exists in this world is minuscule to what will happen in the next world, and so therefore the ultimate reward or the ultimate punishment will again move back if I'm scaring people in the front. The ultimate reward and the ultimate punishment, that is not mentioned in the Torah, because that's not what our focus is supposed to be on. We're supposed to do the right things because they're right, not because of the reward which we will get will happen in the end. Any other suggestions? So that's there is one explanation which is given. This is the first answer that we'll be discussing. It's given by a few of our commentators, a few of our rabbis, the Vilna Gaon, and also the Kuzari, or Yehuda Levi, discuss this, and they say, you know what, the truth is that it is mentioned in the Torah. The concept of the afterlife is explicitly found in the Torah. Because whenever the Torah says a phrase that I will be your God, and you will be my nation, or I will dwell amongst you and within you, that's not referring to this world. That's really referring to the afterlife. Because the afterlife is where we ultimately dwell amongst God. That's our closeness to God is... The closest that, the feeling that we have to God, the closest that we can become to God, is in the afterlife. It's after we pass away. In this world, it's very hard to feel that connection, to feel that closeness, even if we feel it a little bit, or even we think we feel it, but the closest that we'll have after we die won't even compare to what exists in this world. So when the Torah tells us that we'll get close to God, that God will be amongst us, that is referring to the afterlife. And so it is explicitly mentioned in the Torah. It is explicitly mentioned. So we asked, how come it's not mentioned? The answer is that it is mentioned in the Torah. And so that's the second explanation that's given. There is a third explanation which is given, which is the second one over here. I accidentally put two ones here, but it's really the second one, which is given by Rav Sadia Gaon and the Ramban. And this is gonna connect directly into our next topic. And they explain that is there really a need to mention the afterlife? Is it not obvious that there's an afterlife? They assume that it's just... The Torah is there to tell you things that you might not know. But once the Torah already tells you that there's a God, and that you have to do things in this world, and that there's a purpose to the world, so then it's obvious that there's an afterlife. And not only that, but to not believe in the afterlife is also to assume that God is, to a certain degree, cruel. To not believe in the afterlife means that God is cruel. Because if we look around us and we see who the good people are, right, the big question of how do good people suffer and bad people have, some bad people have good lives. So if you don't believe in an afterlife, so then you're essentially looking around the world and you're saying whatever exists in the world is the end. That's the end. So a good person could have a terrible life and a bad person could have a great life and that's it. And so Nachmanides, the Ramban, and Rav Sadia Gaon, but they both explain that it's so obvious. The Torah doesn't even have to tell us that there's an afterlife. It's just so, so obvious that there's an afterlife because there's something that God has to reward those that are righteous. And when's that going to take place? If it doesn't take place in this world, it's going to take place in the next world. And so it must be that there's an afterlife. So the Torah doesn't even have to tell us. The Torah tells us things which we don't know. The afterlife is so obvious. It's so obvious that it doesn't even have to tell us about the concept of the afterlife. And so those are the three explanations which I want to discuss. There are a few more explanations. But just to sum up, one explanation is that it is found in the Torah. We do find the concept of the afterlife in the Torah. That's whenever the Torah describes the closeness that we have to God, that's what it's referring to, because we won't get that in this world. We'll only get that in the next world. A second explanation, is that we don't want to focus on the afterlife, because we want to focus on to do what's right because that's what's right. So we don't want to focus on the reward. We want to focus on what's right and to do what's right. And the third explanation that we gave is that it's so obvious that if you believe that there's a God and that there's a just God, so it must be that there's an afterlife. Because we just look around the world, and if there's a just God, so it's so hard to see that just God. So it must be that there's an afterlife. So now I wanna move on, and for the rest of this class, we're gonna discuss what happens to the soul in the afterlife. Now, I've never been there, and or maybe I have, we'll discuss that. At least I don't remember what happened. And to really understand the afterlife is difficult for us to understand because we don't have a body, we're purely of soul. And to even contemplate such a situation is really impossible. So we're gonna try our best to give a broad view of what happens, but to actually get into the details, we really are not going to understand them. So we're first going to discuss what happens to the soul right after death. Right after death. Between the period of right after death till 12 months later. That's what our first topic is going to be. What exactly happens during that time period? Not exactly, but what we think is what we could contemplate is happening during that time period. And then we'll discuss a broader perspective of what happens in heaven, in Gehenna, in hell, and what happens in when the times of Mashiach, what role does the soul play in the times of Mashiach, the times of Messiah? So that will be more of a broader perspective. But first I want to discuss what happens just directly after death to the soul. And after analyzing this specific point of what happens to the soul after death, we're going to look at it from two different perspectives. We're going to see what role the laws of mourning play and how powerful it is in relating to the soul after death. Now, we're going to have other classes in the future on the psychology of mourning, or of the laws of mourning in Jewish law. And it's very, very powerful in terms of how our law dictates exactly how we're supposed to act from the very beginning, after the person passes away, then by burial, then for the first week, there's something called Shiva. Then there's the month-long shloshim. It's called shloshim, where there are different laws from that of Shiva. And then there's also mourning for the whole year, for a parent. For a parent that exists for the whole year. And in future classes, we're going to discuss how powerful that mourning process is and how much that helps psychologically for the mourner to go through this process as explicated by our rabbis and through the Torah. And we'll get to that, and it's very, very powerful. But there are other elements to the whole mourning process which reflect what happens to the soul itself, which is what we'll deal with now, which is extremely interesting. What the soul goes through, we act in certain ways over this period based on what happens to the soul. So again, just to explain what happens during that 12-month period, what we do before we get to what the soul does. So we all heard of the concept of Shiva, that there are 7 days of mourning that the mourner goes through, those 7 days. It's really, if you go through the Talmud, it's really divided up. It's not just 7 days, but it's really the first 3 days and then the last 4 days. Those 7 days are really supposed to be devoted to complete mourning. It's supposed to be a whole day of mourning. From the time that you wake up till you go to sleep, it's supposed to be quite an exhausting process of reflection during that 7 days. The first 3 days, the Talmud tells us, are days of just complete crying. It's called bethi. Bethi is from bochet, to cry. You're not even able to be comforted during that time period. Even though we do have the practice to comfort the mourners during those first 3 days, that is a practice that we have, but ideally you're really supposed to go after that because they can't be comforted during those first 3 days. It's just complete mourning, complete crying. And then the next 4 days is where they're able to be comforted. They've experienced that crying, that just inner pain and reflection. And then they have the next 4 days where they are able to be comforted to a certain degree. That's the next 4 days. Beyond that, we have the shloshim period. We have the 30-day period where you're no longer sitting in your house, not able to really leave. The law is that you're not supposed to leave your house. You're supposed to stay in your house during those 7 days. Now you're allowed to leave your house, but even when you leave your house, there are still aspects of mourning that you have to retain. You're not allowed to shave. There are different aspects which apply even during those 30 days. And then for a parent, and only for a parent, there are, after those 30 days, for the full year, you're not supposed to have an increased amount of simcha, of joy. You're not allowed to, you're not supposed to go to weddings, or you're not supposed to, depending on the scenario, you're not supposed to go to concerts, let's say. And that's because you're not supposed to have extended joy. You're supposed to continue it. It's not explicit mourning, but you're not supposed to have an elevated amount of happiness. And that's the 12-month period. The Ramban, Nachmanides, asks a very strong question. If we believe in the afterlife, so then why do we have to mourn? If we believe in the afterlife, so then they're going to a better place. They're going to a place where they're closer, as we pointed out, or they're closer to God. They're having a certain experience which we can't even have in this world of closeness with God. So we should be happy for them. They're experiencing something which we can't even experience. What they're going through is a very powerful experience. It's true. We do go through a process of a cleansing process. For those of us that have to get punished for the bad that we do, so then there is a cleansing process. But that ultimately is for good. That's for good. That's ultimately to get closer to God. That itself is also, it's a hard process to deal with, but that's also ultimately for the good. So why is it that we have to mourn at all? Which is, if you think about it, in terms of the afterlife, it's a strong question. Why do we have to mourn for the deceased if they're going to have an afterlife? Any suggestions in terms of that? Why do we mourn? Yes.
Well, while their neshama has gone up, we're still here, and we have to deal with our grief in the best way possible.
Excellent. To that.
Yeah. We missed them.
Exactly. So that's exactly what the Ramban says. The Ramban, Nachmanides, he says that the mourning is really for us. It's for us. They are continuing on to a better world. But just like if a person leaves, somebody that we're very close with goes on a journey and they're never going to come back, we know that they're never coming back. They're going across the world, and it's not in our times where it's such a small world, but it's in a period where you're never going to see them again. So then you're going to experience a similar amount of mourning. You're going to be very upset. I don't know about it's going to be a similar amount, because there's always that hope that they might return or you might see them again. But it's a departure of two very close people. And all the more so if it's an immediate family, so then you're crying, you're mourning over the fact that you lost a loved one. But at the same time, Nachmanides says that you're not allowed to have excessive mourning for this very reason. You're allowed to mourn because your loved one has left you. But to have excessive mourning, the Torah tells us that you're not allowed to injure yourself. You're not allowed to injure yourself over the course of mourning. And so Nachmanides explains the reason why you're not allowed to injure yourself is because you're not allowed to have excessive mourning. Because ultimately, you could cry, and you should cry, and you should have those powerful emotions, but ultimately you can't injure yourself, because you have to realize that there is an afterlife. They are going to a better place. And so we can't harm ourselves in the process. We shouldn't really harm ourselves in that process. And that's what the Ramban says. The reason why we mourn is really for ourselves. I like to suggest, and it's not just my suggestions, these are given by other rabbis, two other reasons as to why we mourn. Nachmanides says that the reason why we mourn is for ourselves, because of the departure of our loved ones. But there's two other explanations that I would like to address today, and we'll also give in the future we'll give additional explanations. And I think this is very powerful. The author of Pelm gives the following explanation. There's the judgment of the soul. The soul, immediately after death, is judged. And that judgment process, and that form of the judgment / punishment process, takes a year. The most powerful time period where they're being judged is right after death. At the very moment right after death, in fact, we're taught that it's basically the first 3 days after death. And then the next point of judgment is the first 7 days. Whatever this means. It's hard to really understand what this means. And then beyond that is the first 30 days is a period of judgment. And then beyond that is the year. You get where I'm going with this. And so judgment is, it's really hard to understand what it means to be judged in the next world or what that punishment is exactly. It's not, Arya Kaplan explains that it's not just it's not the fires of hell. You don't experience the actual fires of hell. It's more of like a replay of your life. You're watching a video of your life where just things are so obvious, like how could I do that wrong? It's like more of like a shame of who you were. It's really, but it's hard to really understand exactly what this judgment is. But this judgment goes from the harshest point of the judgment is right after death. And then it continues, and there are different points of time. It's the first 3 days, 7 days, 30 days, and then a year. And the author of Talmud explains that the reason why we're mourning, and there are different stages in the mourning process, is really it's to share in their pain. He has a very powerful idea that it's to share in their pain and in their suffering. To be nosa olim chavera, to carry that pain with you. And when they are suffering the most, which is those first 3 days, so you're supposed to be constantly crying. You're supposed to feel that pain and experience that pain. Now there is a, and then that's supposed to continue on. For the first 7 days, you're supposed to also have that pain. And that what the mourning process is, to share in that pain. They are going, as you are living those 7 days, through those 7 days, they are also living through those 7 days in pain. And you wanna suffer with them. You wanna show how you care about what they're going through, and you wanna suffer with them. Now there's a concept of being nosef olim chaver, of sharing their pain, even if they don't know about it. There is such a concept, which is found, that somebody could be suffering on the other side of the world, and I still wanna share in their pain. But as we'll see later on, the soul actually also knows that you are sharing their pain, that you're joining them in their pain. They know what's going on in this world, and so they also know that you're sharing in their pain. And so that's what we're doing. For the first 7 days, we had an intense period of mourning, an intense period of pain, and then it goes. We're not feeling the pain, but we're suffering. We are suffering through it. Yes.
So we're assuming that no matter how wonderfully righteous our loved one might have been, at least from our perception, that they're going to go through this whole process.
We'll assume that we'll try to, we don't know what their process, how long their process is going to be. And so therefore we will assume that we will try to experience it if it will go to the max. So there's no other way for us to know. We don't know.
So we assume the worst?
Well, we experience it as though it's the worst. We might not assume the worst, but in terms of how we go about the mourning process, we'll experience. There's a difference between whether we'll assume the person is a good person or not a good person. We'll assume that our parents, our loved ones, our siblings are good people. But in terms of how much are we going to try to share in their pain, so then we don't know how much they're actually suffering, so therefore we will go for that whole 12 months. We'll go through that 12-month period. There's a concept of bringing merit to the soul during this period of judgment and punishment, during that 12-month period. There's been a custom of late to study various holy texts, some various Mishnayos or other holy texts during the 30-day period, during the year period. And it's just important to note that the most intense punishment occurs, the highest level occurs right at the beginning, during the first moments of death, during the first couple of days. And so really, the mourner himself is not supposed to study, but others, if they are studying on their behalf for that soul, the best time to do it is really right after the death. It's really closer to the death. We shouldn't delay it, according to this explanation. We shouldn't really delay it to after 30 days or to after a year. If we really want to bring merit to the soul, we should really do that at the very, very beginning, at the beginning point in time. That's one perspective on the soul in terms of the judgment of the soul. There's also a second part which occurs to the soul, and this is found in the Zohar, and I can't claim to actually know what this means. But the Zohar says that the soul goes through an experience over the course of the 7 days, 30 days, and year. And that the soul itself, besides for being judged, said, the Zohar says that for the first 3 days, the soul wants to connect back with its body. It's hovering over the grave during those first 3 days. It's hovering over the grave and it wants to connect back to the body. It misses that body. We explained last time in the last class how there's a strong connection between the body and soul, and that's why ultimately, which we'll get to, many are of the understanding that the ultimate completion is when the soul returns back to the body and lives with the body because it's such a strong connection. And so during those first 3 days, the soul is hovering over the body. It's not yet in the next world, wherever it's supposed to go to. It's still in this world, hovering over the body. And in fact, it knows what's going on in this world. It knows what's going on, and it's hovering over the grave, trying to connect back to the body, because it misses the body. For the next 4 days, from day four to seven of that Shiva process, the soul is moving from the house of the mourners to the grave. It's shifting back and forth. It's going through a struggle between whether it should get closer to the body, it wants to connect back with the body, this is what the Zohar says, or it moves quickly to the house of where the mourners are, because it wants to be with the mourners. The soul wants to be with the mourners. And that's what occurs from day one to seven. Day one to three, it's only with the, it's solely with the body, trying to connect back to the body. And then one to seven, it's with moving back and forth from the body to the house of the mourners. For the shlokim, for the remaining period until 30 days, it's making its way to the next world. So what we'll call the olam haneshamos, the world of the souls, and it's trying to connect back to the world of the souls, but it's shifting back and forth to the world of the souls and to this world. But it's starting to get accustomed to the next world. Apparently, whatever it means, it's a difficult transition to just purely go to the next world. It takes time to go to the next world, and so there's a transition point where it's going to the next world, but it's also coming back. And then finally, from till the 12 months, till the end of the 12 months, so then the soul is really in the next world, but it has some connection to this world. But it's really mainly in the next world with some connection. And the Zohar tells us that the only time that after those 12 months that it comes back is on the day of the Yartzeit. The Yartzeit, which is the anniversary of the death, so then that's when the soul somehow comes back to this world. And so it's interesting that it's the same exact timetable as our mourning. And our mourning somehow relates to this process of the soul. It's unclear exactly what the connection is, but our mourning does relate to the soul is having this experience of wanting to connect back to the body and wanting to come back to this world, essentially, and is in pain. Essentially, it wants to come back and is in pain over the fact that it's not in this world. So then we are in our most intense point in time of mourning. And when it wants to come back to us, the mourners, when it's hovering between the grave and the house of the mourners, so then there too we're experiencing mourning because it wants to come back to us. So every time that it wants to come back to us and to come back to life, to come back to our lives, so then we are supposed to experience mourning over that time period. And so during the 30 days also, we're experiencing mourning and for the 12 months, and then also every year thereafter, on the day of the Yartzeit, we have also a small level of mourning. Yes?
So, when someone passes and we like to comfort ourselves by thinking that the person who's departed is watching over us or just is this feeling that this sort of comforting feeling that they're sort of around or watching over us, that is not true.
Well, that they're comforting you, that they're.
Well, is it only on the Yartzeit that they sort of interact possibly, or they?
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure about how much they know. Definitely, it sounds like for the first week they're with us. They're in the house of mourning, and then also during that first year, to certain whatever this means, they come back.
2 years later, 3 years later, 10 years later.
I don't know to what extent I don't know to what extent, how much they know about what goes on in this world, how much they're involved in this. It's hard to know exactly how much they're able to provide comfort. We do know is that they're able to provide comfort to us because they're the ones that are guiding our lives. The lives that we live currently are based on what they did in their lives, and that's continuing to guide us. So that should for sure give us a sense of comfort that they're continuing to guide us even though they are no longer around. But in terms of them comforting us as souls, I'm just not sure. Yes.
So where is the concept something that a person says to someone who lost loved one, you say they should be a melee susher, they should be a positive
intercessor.
Thank you.
Intercessor. Yeah.
Is that something that is theoretical? I mean, it's obviously something that you believe because obviously you wouldn't say it otherwise. But I'm saying, is that because someone there aware of what's happening?
It's
it's one thing for us whenever we do something, then they get
they get the merit,
right? And then they're experiencing something, some kind of a aliyah. But the concept of them, when the Torah talks about when the Jewish people went down to Babel when they were exiled, right? And Abraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov, they were talking to God and trying to intercede on behalf of the Jewish people. That was a in-the-moment kind of experience. Now, is it because of them they were unique, or would we assume that this is a privilege that some that more people have? Or
so I'm not sure. It's a good question. It's a good question. Yes?
I just have an idea on what Steve said, that it's just my own personal take on the first 3 days and the intensity of the first 3 days. It's not that we're necessarily assuming the worst, but if the neshama is seeing, the deceased is seeing their life replay for all its joy and its suffering, and even with the things that you didn't necessarily do wrong, but the things that you went through, that is the intensity of the neshama's experience, the intensity of the person.
And then you could also experience it through that.
So it's not just that we're assuming that even though we can see our parents or the person that passed us at Sadek and that they really, their life should replay smoothly, they still went through their own agonies and their own joys. And
yeah, it's an interesting idea.
So they themselves are just having their life replayed and to see it through.
So they're suffering themselves just from going through that experience again.
I'm sure somebody played a movie back of my entire life right now, it would be incredibly intense. And maybe I wouldn't have made mistakes, but the experiences would have been intense.
That's an interesting idea, for sure. Yeah, any other questions? Okay, so that's the two perspectives that we could take in terms of the soul, the experience of the soul after death. In terms of the judgment of the soul, what happens to the soul in terms of its judgment, and also what experience the soul is going through. Where is the soul? Is the soul in this world? Is the soul in the next world? What exactly is taking place? The soul is moving back and forth. Again, these are also two perspectives on mourning itself and the laws of mourning. We will have in the future other perspectives on the laws of mourning. When we go through that mourning process, and the rabbis tell us exactly what we're supposed to be doing that time during that process, it's more than just this. There's a lot of layers in terms of what exactly is going on over the course of the mourning process, and a lot of it is to help us in our comfort and to get back to life. So there is that aspect as well. And so we'll deal with that in future classes. What I want to deal with now is the next world. What exactly happens? The world of the souls. This is the last topic here. The world of the souls, the next world, and the days of Mashiach. It's called the Olam HaNeshamos, the world of the souls. Olam Haba, the next world, and then Yemos HaMashiach, the days of Mashiach. And so I would just like to open this by asking the following question. A couple of years ago, somebody, this is a true story, somebody on eBay wanted to sell their rights to the next world.
No.
They said they had a whole contract, they had two contracts. Up there, they had two contracts. One was just to sell the rights to the next world, and there was a second contract saying, I will continue to do the good things. I'll not change my life around for you not to win out in the end. And he was doing this purely as a joke. It was purely, but I think the bidding started off at like 99 cents, and it got all the way up to $100,000.
Oh my gosh.
So could somebody do such a thing? Could you sell your rights to the next world?
No, you're selling your soul.
You can't.
It's not selling your soul to the devil. You're selling your soul to somebody else.
You can. Why can't you?
Why can't you? Could?
Absolutely. It's the Torah tells you you can.
Where does the Torah say you can?
Aesop.
So there is the story of Aesop doing that. That's correct. But many do interpret this, connects to last week's parsha, to the Torah portion of last week. There are those that explain, not everybody, but there are those that explain that Aesop was selling his soul. He was selling his portion into the next world. There are those. We do say that. Yes.
I don't think it's ours.
Not everybody says that.
I don't think it's ours to sell. I mean,
why is it not ours to sell?
So Hashem created our neshamas, right? And we're released into this world to do something with our neshamas and our bodies. And then after the body's done, the neshama returns to the center. And the idea is so that Hashem can enjoy, I hope, enjoy the improved neshama. And if you're going to sell that portion, I mean, you kind of, you're defeating the whole purpose of why you're here and the whole relationship with Hashem.
The question is whether it's possible to sell it. It's true. It's going to destroy your relationship. It will destroy your relationship with. I think what's behind this question, let's just to deal with this question, what's behind this question is selling your soul. So then you have to reflect on, well, what's happening in the next world? The joy that we receive in the next world. So what exactly is that joy that we receive? So let's give it by way of an example. So I tell my kids to clean their room, which is a good thing. It's good to have your room clean. So I could tell them to clean their room in one of two ways. And I could tell them, clean your room and I'll give you a candy. And they'll clean their room and get the candy. Or I could tell them, and this has never worked, clean your room because isn't it great to have a clean room? It's great to have a clean room. Somehow that hasn't, like, the candy is really. So those are two ways of experiencing what you're doing in this world. I could either say that I'm doing a lot of good in this world, and it is good things that I'm doing a lot of good. And then the reward that I get in the next world, it could be external to that which I did. It's not really connected to my actions. Like cleaning the room. I clean my room, the cleaning of the room and the candy that they get, there's nothing connecting those two concepts of cleaning the room and getting candy, other than the fact that I convinced them to clean the room because they're going to get the candy. But there's nothing internal that connects the two. Or, and then that would be the same thing with the next world. And if that's the case, then perhaps I could sell my soul. Because let somebody else receive that candy. Or whatever happens in the next world, that really big candy. Or, when I do good things in this world, so then it makes me a good person, and that in the next world gives me so much joy over what I became of myself. The joy that happens in the next world is not external joy. It's not like God is giving you a gift. It's just you, based on your life and your experience in life, have done X, Y, and Z, and you have become such a person that in the next world, you will enjoy the next world because of who you are. It's not because of what you're going to get. That's not what the joy is. The joy in the next world is not what you're going to get. But it's just who you are becomes the joy itself. That is the joy. You don't see it in this world. It's hard to see that. Sometimes you do see it. But it's hard to see that clearly in this world. But in the next world, you'll just see what you made of yourself. And that itself will give you the joy. It's something which is internal. And so that is something which is impossible to sell. You can't sell somebody else your life experience.
How come we don't feel that in this world? at least for me, like, I'm not that high level. Like, I need some reward.
Because I think the idea might be, first of all, you could.
What was the question?
So, like, I'm the kind of person, if I do something, I want a reward. Like, I want to see it. You know, like, it's not enough that, oh, yeah, I'm a great person, great, but if I'm always just doing good, but I don't get anything, like, it's hard for me to.
So first of all, why don't you view the good that you do as itself independent? But
I mean, I kind of feel good. But for example, at work, I don't want to work so hard if it's not going to benefit me. If I'm not going to get promoted or more money. After a while, I'm like, I don't want to really do extra work. It's not really
okay. So I think part of why we don't feel it in this world is because in the next world, like what the Rambam, Maimonides, we start off with, he explains that in the next world, we'll get closer to Hashem. That was the Gross, sorry, not Maimonides. That in the next world, we'll have a certain experience where we're closer to God. We have a direct relationship with God, whatever that means. But it's going to be a close relationship with God. So the closer you are with God, the more you realize how important it is, and the ramifications are to being a good person. You'll actually feel it. The closer you are with good, so then you'll understand how great it is to be good. You'll have that direct connection. And so you may not feel it in this world, but in the next world, you'll understand it. That will be the result. The result of your goodness will be experiencing that goodness. It'll be something. The next world is not tangible at all, but it'll be something which you could perceive in this world as tangible. So that's what you'll experience in the next world. But that's the. So there are those who say that you could sell your soul, and it is a big discussion. But there is also an idea that you can't sell your soul, because your experience in the next world is just the life that you created for yourself in this world. That's what it is. It's that life that you created in this world. There's no candy. There's no. You don't get any rewards. It's just the life that you've built. It itself is the reward, and you'll be able to experience that and understand how great it is. The choices you've made are so great, and they have such the implications of your actions are so far-reaching, you don't even know how far-reaching it is, you'll be able to experience that and understand that. That itself will give you a sense of joy. And that's perhaps an understanding of what occurs in the afterlife.
Sorry, you actually said that the person offered to sell the rights to get the rights to the offer.
That was the story that happened. Yeah.
That's not the same thing as selling yourself. Because what you, at least the way I look at it, the way I look at it is there's a journey in the soul. There's a journey in that year. And I'm assuming from what you're saying that every soul will get eventually into the afterlife with either more or less merit. It depends on various things that I've done during that.
There are a few people that don't have any. For the vast, vast majority, they do. Correct.
The vast majority, some people won't get in. Therefore, what this person is saying, I'm a meritorious person. I'm going to sell you the ability to get into the afterlife by giving you merit.
So again, if getting into the afterlife is just the experience of your life, there's no way to sell that. If what you see, what happens at the end of the tunnel is just your own life experience, there's no way for somebody else to get that. Because each person lives a different life. So ultimately, I can't sell you anything that has to do with my soul. Because what's going to happen in the afterlife is just intrinsic to what I went through. So it's impossible for me to sell that.
So, and there's really no selling of rights. There's only owning what you've experienced.
Exactly.
Very well said.
So as we go through this, we're going to go through what happens, and also this explanation. I just want to, if you turn the page, we have a few sources here. If you go to the second source, is the Talmud, in Tractate Brachos. It says, "V'amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba Amar Yochanan Kol Hanavim Kulan Lo Nisnavu Eli Mos HaMashiach." Rabbi Yochanan says that when the prophets had their prophecy, So of what would happen in the future, it was only about the days of Mashiach. And we'll discuss exactly what the days of Mashiach are, but it's not the next world, Olam Haba. Olam Haba is the next world. So this, first of all, tells us that there's a difference between Olam Haba, the next world, and the days of Mashiach. Apparently there are two different concepts here. There's one concept of Olam Haba, and of the next world, and the days of Mashiach. Now in addition, whatever we're saying about the next world, not only, why couldn't a Navi, a prophet, talk about it? Because it's just something which we can't comprehend, which we can't understand. So even though I tried to give a glimpse of what it might be like, obviously this is something which we can't really fully understand. This is not something which we could completely understand. To the extent that God couldn't even give it over to the prophets. God couldn't tell the prophets what would happen in the next world, because the next world is just impossible for us to understand. We'll explain. The days of Mashiach, the days of the Messiah, are in this world, are in a physical world. So at least something which is in the physical world, the prophet could explain. But when we're dealing with the world of the soul, and what happens to the soul itself without the body, so that's just impossible. God couldn't even give that over to the prophets. And so really what we're going to try to describe a little bit, but it's not really, we can't get any clear picture as to what really is going on. I also just, I wanted to mention this earlier, but once we flip the page, the first source here says that every Jew has a portion in the next world. And then it says in the end that there's a very, very small group which does not get a portion in the next world, and one of them is not believing in the resurrection of the dead. If you don't believe in the resurrection of the dead, then you do not get a portion in the next world. And so part of that is what we said before, which was the idea that there has to be something beyond this world. If there's nothing beyond this world, so then we can't make sense of what's going on right now. So there has to be something which is beyond this world. So to believe that there's nothing beyond this world means that you believe in a cruel God. Either you don't believe in God at all, or you believe in a cruel God. And so therefore you have to believe that there's something beyond. There has to be resurrection of the dead, or there has to be something beyond this world. And otherwise you wouldn't be able to experience that that portion in the world to come. Just the one that gave this explanation of the next world being our life experience was given by a few people. It was given by Maimonides. It was also given by Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim of Elazhin. Just I'm not making it up. I'm quoting from these people. So what happens? What happens after the soul, after we die, after the soul dies? What's the broader picture? So there are a few of our leading rabbis, of our leading philosophers of the 12th to 14th century, they dealt with these issues and beyond. The Ramban, Nachmanides, he has a whole book devoted to this, devoted to reward and punishment and the next world. And he explains as follows. He says that after we die, we go to something called the Olam HaNeshamos, the world of the souls. That's not Olam Haba. That's not the next world. But it's a temporary world where we experience what he calls Gan Eden or Gehenna, which, for lack of a better term, heaven and hell. And that's an experience that we have which is not going to last forever. That's a temporary place where if we have to get punished, so then it's really to really purify our souls so that we get ultimately the good. We have to go through some sort of purification process, which will involve pain and shame within that. But ultimately it's for the good. And we'll also, there are those, the righteous will experience a time period of heaven, of connection to God, which we'll explain what that means in a few minutes. Then, in this world, we will have Mashiach come. Mashiach will come in this world, independent of what's happening with our souls. Now, when the Messiah comes, that's only impacting this world. When there's complete peace in the world, and everybody is able to serve God appropriately and understand who God is, so that's going to occur in this world. That's not connected to what happens to the soul yet. That's just purely in this world. Then, at a certain point in time, there'll be the resurrection of the dead. And at that point in time of the resurrection of the dead, the souls that are in this temporary place, this Gan Eden and Gehenna, that temporary place, will come back to the body during that resurrection of the dead. And after the resurrection of the dead, that's not called the days of the Mashiach, the days of the Messiah, but that is now Olam Haba. That's now the next world. And that next world is the ultimate purpose of creation. The ultimate purpose of creation is for the body and the soul to come back together to live and serve God in ultimate perfection. That's what the end game, that's what the end game is. When the soul and the body come together and serve God. Now many philosophers and many of our leading rabbis question this by saying, why do we need the body for this? They said, why is there, and we'll see, Maimonides holds that the end is not where the soul is with the body, the soul is independent of the body. But based on our discussion from the last class, we discussed how connected the body and the soul are. That the body has experienced such a life with the soul that they're really integrated and connected, that it returns, and that's really the end game is where the body and the soul are together, according to the Ramban, according to Nachmanides. There are different versions given by others. There is a school of thought which says that there's the resurrection of the dead occurs both during the times of Mashiach. When Mashiach comes, there'll be the resurrection of the dead. People will die during the times of Mashiach, and then there'll be a second resurrection of the dead for Olam Haba, for when it's the soul and the body in this state of perfection. There are those that say that there are two different time periods of the resurrection of the dead. Now the Rambam, Maimonides, is of the opinion that the end game is where the soul is independent of the body. That really, it's purely the soul. All we care about, all God cares about in the end is just the soul. And I want to read this last source here. It's in English. This is a translation of what the Rambam discusses in a couple of places, Maimonides. I picked one place where he discusses what happens in Olam Haba, in the next world. And this is in the last source here in English. He says, the hidden good in store for the righteous is a life in the world to come, which is a life connected with no death and a kind of good connected with no evil. I'm skipping a little bit. The reward of the just is that they will acquire the sweetness thereof to be in such goodness. And the punishment is that they will not share in such life, but will suffer. And then he goes on and he says, and whoever does not earn such life is to be dead without coming to life forever. Basically, he's saying that the next world is life which will exist forever, and it will have such goodness. And then in the next paragraph, he says, the world to come will not have a body, it will just be the soul, as we mentioned, save only the souls of the righteous, divested of body, as are the ministering angels. We'll just be like the angels where we just have a soul. And it says that there'll be no concrete form, there is no need for eating, drinking, or other of the bodily necessities of the sons of men in this world. And he goes on to say, in the last sentence, he goes on to say that what will ultimately happen is that the righteous are sitting, and there'll be nena mizev hashchina. They'll get pleasure from mizev hashchina, from the radiance of the Shechina, of God. And that's what the world to come is. Again, these are just terms without really understanding what they are. But the world to come will be just the soul itself getting pleasure from the radiance of the Shechina, of God Himself. And that's ultimately what will happen in the end. And that's the whole process. Now, the details that we've discussed are really hard to understand. The actual details of what's occurring. But I think it's important to have a big picture of what's happening. One, for multiple reasons. One, to understand that there is a reward and punishment, and God is a just God, and in the end of days, at the end of time, the righteous will be rewarded, and the wicked will suffer, and there is a just God. And it's also important to just have an understanding of what's occurring to your loved one, to over the process of what's happening to the soul, of the suffering of the soul, of knowing what you could do for the soul. When you do good deeds, so then it's for the purpose of it can impact your loved one, it can impact that soul. It's because of that loved one that you are who you are today, and you continue to live the life of that of your loved one through being in this world. And it's not just you, but it's what you give over to everybody else, to your children, and to for all future generations, and to your community. And so that continues to exist. And the more that you do, the more that the soul it has an impact on this world, the more that you're able to impact what occurs to the soul in its world, in the soul's world, in the next world. And so we have that ability to really make an impact on that soul. And the impact that we make is purely because of the impact that soul had on us. And so we're able to just give back to that soul. And that really should be a comforting thought for those of us who unfortunately have gone through this experience, that we're able to continue to, even though they're not physically alive, but we're able to continue the lessons and what they have taught us. We're continuing to do that, and we're able to give that off to our family and to our friends and to our community. And that should be something which exists forever, and that then also impacts the soul itself. What happens to the soul in the next world continues to be impacted based on what happens in this world. Any questions? Yes.
You use terms like wicked and honorable. What constitutes a wicked man?
I'm not one to. There is a group of people that the Talmud tells us are gonna. They're not gonna get any. They're gonna have charis. They're not gonna have any life in the after death. They won't have any afterlife. They'll not experience that. But beyond that, God is the one that's gonna decide who's. It's not like a person's wicked and a person's righteous. There are many shades and there are many colors to this. It's not like one person goes to heaven and another person goes to hell. We all probably experience a certain amount of hell and a lot of heaven. It's not like it's not absolute. We don't refer to this in absolute terms. Any other questions?
You mentioned that we can help the soul of our loved one by doing good deeds ourselves. So, you know, in a sense, we're enhancing that journey of that soul to come and to enjoy an even enhanced closeness with God ultimately.
Yes. I believe I mentioned this last time, I'm not sure. But our rabbis tell us that the righteous, when they're dead, are called really alive. And the wicked, when they're alive, are really dead. Because the righteous, when they're dead, they're really alive because they're continuing to. They're not physically here, but their message, what they wanted to give over, the purpose of life, and doing good in this world, and following God, so they're continuing to give that over. And the wicked, the life is defined on doing good and following the ways of God. So, if you're not such a person, so then you're not living. Life is defined by such a person. You're not living if you're not such a person.
So my question is, if a person dies and has no family, is completely alone, he dies, nobody there to think of him, he just dies. And so first of all, a righteous man dies. What, can we do anything about that for the soul of life?
Yes, I think.
And if a wicked man dies, can we do anything about the soul?
So it's hard to imagine a situation where a person totally lives isolated. We all live within a community, within a culture. So even if we don't have family, hopefully he has friends. And even if such a person doesn't have friends, unfortunately, so then if they're such a righteous person, so then they could still have an impact on the world. It's not like they won't have an impact on the world. The closest impact you could have is to family and then to friends. But a person, just based on their deeds, they could have an impact. You don't even know what impact you can make. You don't know who's watching you. You don't know who benefits from your actions. So it's impossible to tell. So they could still have an imprint on this world even after death. Yes.
Just there's a famous story. A guy who came to a rabbi in Texas who got a phone call. He said, "Rabbi, I would like to come and make a donation to your shul." And guy was never in shul before, and he rabbi like. like, why are you giving us money? I mean, we're not going to say no, but why are you giving us money? And he said, I was just in Israel, Rabbi, and I was at the Western Wall, and I saw a man, and I saw him pray. And I never saw a man pray like that in my life. And I was talking to a tour guide, and I said, you know, what, you know, he was dressed funny. He said, oh, that's an Orthodox Jew. So I decided I'm going to come back here to Texas, and I'm going to find Orthodox Jews in Texas, and I'm going to give them money, right? This guy, this Orthodox Jew that was praying at the Western Wall, he's not even aware that this guy was noticing him. Meanwhile, he went, and he's supporting a shul. And the guy who was praying, he gets the merit for all that charity that the man gave, right? And all the efforts that the shul is putting into it, teaching Torah, services, and davening. And then all those ding, 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 ding. It's like, you know, winning the lotto at the casino. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we do things that we just don't realize, and I think that's what's so beautiful, or what Rabbi said about when a person comes up and they get to appreciate what they did, because we don't always get to see what we do. But yeah. So I think people who do have family are luckier. They do have. It's not everyone has it.
There's a concept, this just reminds me, there's a concept, and then we'll finish with this, called Maris Ayin, which is that even if you're doing the right thing, mm-hmm. but if it's being perceived as the wrong thing, so then you're not allowed to do it. Because you're always being watched. Not only is God watching us all the time, mm-hmm. but people are watching us all the time.
Yeah.
And so we can make an impact on this world without even realizing it. We don't realize what kind of impact we can make on this world. I know for myself, just personally, some of the people who have influenced me the most don't even know who they are. Just from me observing them, and like, wow, that's amazing. I should probably go over to them and tell them, but I haven't. Told a few, not everyone. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
I don't know if you said this, maybe I missed it. So when you pass away, do you know if you can connect with the people who are living there, your family and friends?
So you do. So there is a kind. I believe there is a concept of having awareness of what's going on in the world.
Or see what's going on.
Yeah, having awareness of what's going on in the world. I forgot to mention this. That I don't know that much about this, but there is a dispute whether there is a concept of a Gilgul HaNeshamos. That during this state where the soul is in either is waiting for the Olam Haba, for the next world, so there's a dispute amongst our commentators whether they could come back to this world to fix. There are different reasons that are given, either to fix a specific trait that they have to work on, or it's just for some reason. This also I don't understand that Gehenim, hell, can't purify this part, so therefore they have to come back to this world to fix it. This is a dispute. This is not clear at all, but there are the Ramban, Nachmanides believes in such an idea, and others disagree. The Sefer Yekarim is an example who disagrees. This is a dispute which is found amongst our early leading rabbis as to whether there's a concept of coming back to this world.
When you're talking about coming
for reincarnation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, reincarnation.
And if that happens, if you take on that position, so during the time of the resurrection of the dead, which body?
That's a great question.
Does it reconnect with?
That's a great question. I think they deal with this. They deal with. I don't know. I'm not familiar with this. But I think this is a question. They ask other questions. Forget about which body. They say, who are you married to?
Yes.
And then. The co-wives are going to fight about it. So.
Maybe it's the same soul.
Maybe they're married to the same soul.
So.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. Okay, thank you. I hope this was helpful.
Thank you very much.
There is no... This class is not going to need...